Hello and welcome back to the Art Persists podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. I am delighted to say that for our season 6 finale we have a two-part episode. Today will be part 1 and next week part 2 will come out with the amazing filmmaker, writer and journalist Dr. Miriam Francois. And for the first time ever, this episode is also being released as a video podcast, which you can find via the link in the description or on YouTube. So if you're listening to the podcast and you want to be watching it, please head over there. A final note from me before we get started. The Art Persists podcast is on Patreon, and for as little as £3 a month, you can help us do more episodes like this. So if you are interested, you can find links in the description to help support our work. Thank you.
Hello everyone, this is Hossam Fazula, co-host of Bosler Arts, and we're very happy because today we're doing our first actually video podcast, and we have with us the amazing Dr. Miriam Francois. And to those who do not really know enough about Dr. Miriam Francois, aside from being probably the best spoken person you've ever seen, she is also an amazing journalist, producer, and a presenter as well. Dr. Miriam,
thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an important time for us to be talking, so thank you for having me.
Okay, so my first question for you, and I have a bit of an idea, is how are you? How have you been? It's been crazy, I guess, almost a year.
Yeah.
So how are you?
I mean, I would say that I live in a state of incandescent rage. That's my perpetual state of being, which sometimes oscillates into deep distress, obviously, in the face of what we see daily. But I think it's obviously the combination of rage and sadness is a product of both the horrors that we have all been witnessing for 7 months, and my personal proximity to people that are directly affected by it obviously makes that particularly difficult. But I think it's the combination of that with the societal gaslighting of this situation, and the moral exceptionalism that we have seen normalized around the mass killing of Palestinians, including Palestinian children. I just saw, you know, some kind of op-ed written yesterday that was saying, you know, trying to claim that there are certain rules under which it's permissible to kill children. I mean, we have seen every single moral red line, the sort of basis upon which the West has constructed its sense of universalist self, which obviously has been one of the ideological lubricants to justify Western expansionism in both violent and non-violent forms, right, has been this idea that the West is a carrier, purveyor of these universal and universally good values. And of course, we know this not to be true through the stories the Global South has always told of what the West truly represents. But I think that the Gaza conflict in particular has really brought to the fore, for many people who may not even have been aware of that, and particularly grotesquely for those of us who have been aware but maybe hadn't been reminded in a while, of just how demonic the true face of the West is. To me, I use the word demonic in full recognition of what that means to me. These are dark forces that will use moral justifications to continue to allow children to be burnt in tents, to allow, you know, displaced people to be fleeing from one place to the next, never knowing what a place of safety will be. It will allow the bombing of hospitals, the sniping of children. It will allow the mass torture of Palestinian hostages in Israeli prisons under some kind of guise that this is to protect Israel. That within those prisons, the sexual assault of minors, of women, which has been going on for decades, you know. And so in answer to your question of how I can only be as well as those that I see suffering, and their suffering has only increased. It's been levels of pain and suffering which we keep thinking can't get worse and continue to get worse. and levels of political frustration that continue to grow, because every single time we are told there is a red line, Rafah being obviously the obvious red line that Biden had stated, you know, he'd not support an invasion of Rafah. And of course, we're then simultaneously hearing these, you know, 1,000-pound bombs being dropped on people sat and sleeping in tents and seeing the after effects of that. So I'm not okay, but I think that's a pretty right, that's where I should be. That's where we all should be at this point. I don't know how anyone is okay right now, knowing what is happening in Rafah to a population deprived of food, water, medication, and being bombed in tents. I don't know how to be okay with that.
Yeah, well, oh my god, like you know what, like I've been writing questions here, but
let's talk.
You just went in so deep.
Yeah, it's
so okay. I'll tell you what, so
as an Egyptian, I'm sure you have your own thoughts around and feelings around this.
Yeah, where do I start? Honestly, I think it started obviously when Ukraine happened, and then you started seeing all the media people saying, "Oh, these are white people, these are people that look like us, these are civilized people," and that was somehow a shock to me because I didn't, like, of course I knew that this is the state of the world, but I didn't know that it can be that people can be that blatant about it. So when I first saw you, it was not the actually very famous interview with Sky News. But I just thought, like, who is this person? Like, what are the making of this person? And then I read more about you. And I think we went to the same uni, SOAS, right? So, and I just realized that you have a lot of mixed experience and a bit of duality in yourself as well. And it made me understand you more, but I wanted you to speak a bit more about it. Obviously, you're a white person, but somehow you kind of went from being white person to being non-white and then back to white again. And I'm sure that you did this with such awareness to actually use your whiteness, which is what you're doing, which is I find amazing. So can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, so I guess I would say not duality and more multipolarity, in that mm-hmm. the more I read about different systems of knowledge in the world, the less I think that the very sort of polarizing understanding, which is, you know, the idea that there's always two sides, which is what so much of how we think in the West is based, by the way. I would say, for example, we think of if you look at debates in parliament, you know, it's like there's the for and then there's the against. And we know that actually in reality on any given topic, there's like the hardcore fors and the hardcore against. And then there's like a whole range of other views in the middle. But of course, we're encouraged to think of things in the sense of like you're either for or you're against, as opposed to actually maybe there's a more interrelational way of conceiving of different things. So I would say in terms of my own identity, I'm French and Irish in terms of my ancestry, but I was born in Camden here in the UK, in London. I'm a Londoner through and through. London has shaped me. When I say London, I say London because I think London has got a very distinct energy about it. A lot of that sadly has changed post-Brexit, but we've always been a city where we are proudly immigrant. All of us are proudly immigrant. I regularly joke that I don't know anyone that's British. I don't even see a problem with that. I know some people might, but like as a Londoner, everyone I know is hyphenated. Everyone I know has, you know, multiple identities.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've always grown up with a sense that multiple identities draw you into multiple forms of solidarity and multiple forms of connection with other parts of the world. And in my particular case, and there's nothing really that special about me in that sense. I think there are lots of people who have multipolar aspects to themselves, but I'm obviously French and Irish, which connects me to those two places. Ireland with its own, you know, history of resistance to British imperialism, arguably ongoing resistance to British colonialism, a long history of solidarity with the Palestinians as occupied people and parallels understood there. Mm-hmm. On my French side, we have, you know, a revolutionary history, which is based in Whether that materialized in our current juncture or not is for another debate. But in terms of our history, at least the idea of a popular revolution, an uprising of the people for the people by the people, that is what we have built our sense of identity on.
Yeah.
So I think that we, those two things have definitely been core aspects of shaping my person and my view of the world. And then in addition to that, like I said, I think growing up a Londoner, where to me, the existence of multiple identities around me was something I just always thought was really cool. Like, I just really enjoyed going to people's houses and like having Ethiopian food, meeting, things, auntie who's just got back from Ghana. Like, this is richness. This is literal richness me. This is what I would call cultural richness.
Of course.
And then being Muslim, I'm tied through my ethical...
So obviously when I said you became non-white, I meant...
Yes.
When you wore the hijab and right. anyone's like
in perception,
not anyone's like in specific white perspective, you became an Arab woman.
Yeah. So I'm Muslim. I wore a headscarf for most of my adult life. So all through my 20s and early 30s. And I, at that point, was definitely being racialized as non-white by white people predominantly, even non-white people would assume that I had some there must be a connection, there's some Lebanese, there's some Syrian, there's something in there that we can't quite see, but it's there. But it feels very different when it comes from non-white people than it does from white people, because non-white people, it's an inclusivity thing. It's like, oh, you're one of us, but like, even though we can't fully see it, but we could tell, and that's a sense of inclusivity and belonging and connection. Whereas what I was getting from predominantly white people was a sense of an automatic barrier which separated me from them. And there were a number of hoops that were required for me to jump through in order to pass the threshold of acceptability.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a savage, so that wasn't gonna work. So I'm proudly non-willing to conform with this notion of civility, which is largely a cover for refusing to disrupt forms of white supremacy and how they operate culturally, which is, if you confront them, you're being uncivilized. If you, speak up on them, you're causing a fuss. You're making people uncomfortable, and we should be making people feel very uncomfortable right now when it comes to the standards that this culture has established in terms of the hierarchies of human value and, endemic racism that has now flourished, in my opinion, in the last few years, to the point where now, you're more likely to be punished by the law as a brown person making a joke about your prime minister by drawing some coconuts than you are for actually making racially aggravated comments about, senior black officials or everyday people. That in itself tells you where we are. And so there's no time for civility anymore. We're done with that. The period for rebellion and fight back and resistance in every sphere where we operate is now. I see no other way right now.
Oh yeah, like honestly, your answers just stunned me. Like I forget what is my next question.
No, don't worry, we could talk about whatever you want.
No, this is really well put. I love how you identified yourself within the larger context of what's happening, that I cannot even put it into words, but you just did it now really well. I'm not going to try to attempt and repeat what you said.
Just before we continue this episode, we want to tell you about a podcast we love listening to. It's called Media Storm, hosted by journalists Matilda Mallison and Helena Wadia. Media Storm is a weekly news and current affairs podcast, but one which focuses on the most underreported and misreported news stories. The hosts tackle the headlines with the most important people in the story, the voices missing from the mainstream news. You'll hear the lived experience of refugees, gender minorities, climate activists, and more. The show forces us to look beyond the Western worldview and gets to the facts behind all the fear-mongering, which is so important, especially in the run-up to the general election. So search MediaStorm wherever you get your podcasts. We highly recommend you check it out.
So you've got a production company. It's called...
MPWR Productions.
Yes. And you've got a quote there that is really like, we felt that it's it goes so well with what we do, because Art Persists and our organization, Bosla Arts, that started this, which is me and Georgia Beeston, right there. We are all about how do we use the power of art for social change, and and also like transnational solidarity, because that's what we think that like the most important sort of like trait that we need to have at the moment.
Yeah.
So I knew in the stream, your program as well, you've done a lot of work about how art has played a role in what's happening nowadays, and obviously as we speak now, the whole Rafah thing is happening, and it's getting even worse. The whole situation of Gaza, like when you think it's not that this, it's peaked, it gets worse, which is, it's really devastating. So I wanted to hear from you. What, obviously you are a filmmaker yourself. I wanted to hear from you. What's the role of art? Why do you think art is important in that time, in this time now?
So I come from a journalistic background, and I got into filmmaking because I realized that there were constraints within the world of journalism that essentially didn't allow for the artist spirit to truly exist.
I used to work for BBC.
Okay, well, there you go. So you know exactly the journey that 100%. I'm talking
about. I worked in the arts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the arts is a space for... the misfits, the dreamers, the marginals, those who refuse to bend to the assumptions and demands of our society, which is why artists historically have also often quite literally lived at the margins, you know, economically and socially. There's a reason for that, because the space that the artist occupies is one which in many ways, by pushing the boundaries of what is and what can be, allows us to dream of another world, of another way of being, of another way of seeing. And so I very much connect the attack on the arts, I mean the structural attack on the arts that we've seen over the last decade, with a huge slashing of funding, state funding for the arts.
Yeah.
I very much connect that to the wider situation in which we find ourselves, where the government that we have just had in power has sought to shrink the space of legitimate resistance. They've done that obviously through some of the new powers that have been brought into the police when it comes to the right to protest, also brought in through the ways in which hate laws are being used to silence people. You know, I gave the example of the young woman who was convicted over the coconut placard that she'd created of Rishi
Sunak.
She was
right next to me.
Yeah, right. I mean, she herself is Asian. So these race hate laws are now being used to punish the people to protect the wealthy, regardless of race. That's what has just happened, that these laws have been used to protect the wealthy from criticism. And I think that, as I was saying, the connection is that the arts, because it creates a space where people can dream, people can consider possibilities outside of the strictures of a sort of utilitarian approach to the world. You know, it's like, you know, are you earning enough money? Have you achieved your next promotion? Have you, you know, all these sort of symbolic measures of a successful life. A successful civil life, to come back to our earlier conversation around civility, that the artist in many ways rejects those norms, and in rejecting them places them in question and is therefore inherently dangerous. Like, the artist is inherently dangerous, and I say dangerous in that I think we people in power should be scared. They should be scared of the people. They should be scared of us and the power that we have.
That's why they're censorship. They kind of know.
They kind of know what? Sorry.
That they should be scared of artists.
That they should be. Well, yeah, but they're not, in my opinion. They're not right now. And they need to be reminded.
I don't want them to be more scared of artists.
I think they need to be reminded of where power lies. Yeah. And I think there needs to be a refresh, our own reset, as it were, when it comes to how the our societies are structured. And so the place of the artist, to come back to your original question for me in all of this, is, you know, the role of the artist is always to create art, but the function of art is multiple. And within that, I see a space of cultivation of joy, or the potentiality of joy, and the cultivation of joy is one part of resistance.
Yeah.
Those of us who have been engaged in resistance on our own terms over the last few months will know that you can get so, you know, affected by what's happening, that if you don't find spaces of joy to literally resource yourself, then you won't be able to keep up this fight, which is not a fight that we're in for months. This is years, this is decades, this is potentially even beyond our lifetime. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, we also have to get away from the idea that somehow we are the savior generation, or that we are the savior people that are going to tip the balance. And, you know, I don't think any of us should be going into the work we do on this particular struggle thinking we are going to make the decisive change. You know, we are part of a swell that has been building for generations, for over 76 years. We stand on the shoulders of previous generations of resistance giants who didn't see liberation in their lifetime. And we may, who knows, but I think that it's also just really important for us to remember that our role is to just cultivate the energy and the momentum and the strength to be able to continue the fight through our generation and onwards. And so in that, the artist plays multiple roles. I see mine partly as telling stories that are going to help people see and enter worlds that they may not be familiar with, and in particular subvert assumptions that you might have about those people or those worlds. So for me, for example, I take a lot of joy from the fact that the main character of my documentary debut,
Finding Allah,
is a 76-year-old, now 78-year-old Algerian grandfather who we never see on screen. You never see older Algerian guys on screen. You never see people his generation centered in a story. And there's multiple reasons for that. I think that you know, that there's ageism, there's racism, and then there's classism all at work. You know, he is not meant to be a hero. He's a working class, older, brown man. You know, these are the people we see, but we don't see, right? Mm. They're the ones that they, you know, if you enter a room, they might be present, but no one will acknowledge. Like, that's the people.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, for me, the real heroes that I've met in my lifetime are always those people.
Mm.
They're always those people. Like, every hero, real hero, you know, at this point, you know, fuck Superman, fuck Marvel. Like, we're not talking about people, this one person coming to save the world. We're talking about people who decide to be the heroes of their own lives and go about and achieve extraordinary things, which are, you know, those things are very rarely recognized or even heard beyond their small world. And so what I love doing as a filmmaker is taking people who are everyday heroes, heroes of their own lives, whether you agree with their, you know, what it is that they're trying, their meta goal that they're trying to achieve or not, is almost you know, irrelevant to me. The most important thing is seeing people recognize their own power and go on a journey to actualizing it in a way that you know, in theory, creates positive change for them and others. Yeah.
Before the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell I'm going to talk about your interview.
Yeah.
The famous interview where you were talking about Yemen.
The Sky News interview.
The Sky News interview, yeah. I'm sure you got a lot of questions about that interview afterwards. But I think my question to you is, why does it seem like some people are talking a language and they all understand each other, and some other people like don't, or pretend that they don't understand what these people are saying? Is it, what is this sort of division that is happening? Is it a division between humane and inhumane? Is it division between racist, non-racist? Is it a division between white supremacists and decolonizers? You know what I mean? Like, what's happening? What's going on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I personally see it as ultimately, there's a writer, spiritual writer who I am a big fan of called Guy Eaton, God rest his soul. And he has written multiple books, but in one of the books he talks about this idea that as humans, we can't be facing two directions simultaneously. And he, he's a Muslim, he talks about you're either facing the towards God and the search for spiritual growth on the path towards God, which seeks to minimize the value of the material world and places kind of the higher values of the spiritual realm ahead of anything else, or you're facing in the diametrical opposite direction, which is the materialist world. And if you're in the materialist world and the ultimate goal at the end of that path is the accumulation of wealth and status and power, then all of the spiritual values in many ways become secondary to the ultimate goal, which is money, profit, accumulation of wealth. And that's how we end up hearing people talk about things like, you know, 100,000, 200,000 Iraqis is collateral damage. You know, these are just collateral damages of the ultimate goal, which is the securing of, you know, our energy needs for the next, you know, 20 years or whatever it might be, or 30 years. So in that sense, I think it's ultimately about your orientation with regards to how you think about the world. And I don't think that it's exclusive to spiritual people to be able to hold those values. By the way, I've just come back from a philosophy festival, and I think there are, you know, people who don't have a kind of spiritual grounding to their work and somehow have established a philosophical outlook where, you know, the higher values of human dignity and equality and fairness and justice are still centered in how they see the world. But it's not true of everyone. It's definitely a case that some people consider those values to very much be secondary. And I think the higher you climb the corporate and political ladder, the less emphasis there is on the value of human life, and the more there is on the idea that actually human life is one variable among many in the different matters that we have to consider with regards to, say, the long-term, you know, success of our civilization. I mean, you know, China is prepared to kill a million people to advance its, you know, sense of an economic revolution. It's, you know, this is necessary for the progress of humans. Like, so I think that's where the real division comes into it. But you know, ultimately, I think that capitalism, you know, as a sort of unbridled economic system, which has not had anyone been willing to put meaningful barriers around it to protect us from its excesses, which are in effect the excesses of the small number of economically hyper successful companies who are able to regulate the markets and who are able to define economic policies in a way that are favorable to them. So we have this idea, for example, that, you know, capitalism operates without, you know, any restrictions from governments, because, you know, the free market is the argument that's won, but effectively it's working in the interests of the kind of 1% of companies in the world who are able to influence how political power operates around those issues. And in many ways, I think Grace Blakely has just written about this in her book Vulture Capitalism. You know, socialism is basically just saying, well, it's not that anyone has ever allowed capitalism to exist completely free of any restrictions or any, you know, parameters. It's just those parameters have been in service to the 1%, and socialism is essentially saying it needs to be in service to the majority. And so this is somehow obviously a very radical view, because it involves, you know, Robin Hooding the 1% who've been trying to convince us that this is all a meritocracy and they just happen to be, you know, so much more beautiful and glamorous than the rest of us that they deserve all the money that's come their way.
Okay. I think now it's like a good, that was like a good segue to my next question, which is back about the film, because in your film, Finding Allah, there was this sort of message of hope. And I want to know if how this applies to nowadays. So basically the family of the attackers and the family of the victims in the story, this is a real life story, obviously. They come together, and I wanted to ask you, is this a message of hope that you wanted to put in there? And when it comes to what's happening now with this sort of division that we just spoke about, do you think that there is a way that we're somehow gonna come together?
So was I trying to send a message of hope? I actually was trying to reflect what I felt was the true lines in the sand that had been drawn in the aftermath of that attack. And so in the aftermath of the 2015 terrorist attacks in Paris, but not just that, but also terrorist attacks that had happened from ISIS or Al-Qaeda previously, we sort of saw emerge this idea that it was like Muslims against the rest of society. And of course, there was a lot of blah on low. No, not all Muslims, but effectively the governments of various countries affected would bring in policies that, if you know, did blanket sort of target Muslim communities as a whole and end up criminalizing, as did the media, large portions of the Muslim community. And there was a lot of like aleatory, detention and interrogation and harassment, arguably, of Muslim communities during these periods. What I wanted to convey was that the assumption that the line in the sand that would be drawn after such an attack would be between Muslim and non-Muslim was not the truth. The true line that emerged was actually these two fathers had met in the aftermath of this attack, and the most significant thing that they found to bond on was the loss of a child.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the single most horrific thing that can happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think there's anything worse than losing a child.
Mm.
And I think that for these two men, whom everyone was assuming that they would meet and be opposed because they were allegedly on these two sides of the attacks, they met and they were like, I get it. Like, you're dealing with this immense grief, and I'm dealing with this immense grief. And then after that, there are all sorts of subsequent conversations around what happened to your child and what happened to my child and how did this happen. But it was very interesting to me that the first point of connection was at the point of grief and loss.
Mm.
And I think that that spoke to me about the way in which the divisions that we then create are very politically convenient. Because actually, if you could imagine an alternate reality where we'd focused more on this idea of shared loss and shared grief, that actually the divisions that might emanate subsequently might not be the ones that we saw, but might be around those who are unable to recognize the common humanity that binds us and those that are, right? Which is a completely different division. It would be one that says, you know, we understand that these families have also experienced a loss in their own way, and we choose to embrace them within our common sense of grief. Because everyone in France was affected by what happened, you know. I mean, one of my very close friends, his cousin was the head of security at the Bataclan that night, Noumouké Sidibé, who's become since a national hero because he saved a number of people's lives. I mean, the guy is a French, French Muslim of African background. I mean,
nobody knows about
that. No one gave a shit. No.
Not in the news.
But so, because I knew these stories and because I knew that there were Muslims also killed at the Bataclan, the lines that had emerged to me felt very politically expedient for the kind of discourse that emerged thereafter that was feeding the far right. And I didn't feel that they actually reflected the conversations that I was having when I was going and speaking to victims of families of direct victims, as in people who were killed in these instances, and the families of those who'd perpetrated or been involved in acts of terrorism, that who were also just experiencing their own grief. And when I saw them together, because I would attend these meetings where these families on both sides would meet, those were not the divisions that emerged in the room. There were clear friendships across this division. And what would emerge more were maybe divisions on how to deal with the aftermath. The people who didn't want the children to be brought back from Syria because they somehow represent a security risk, and the others just saying, oh my God, like if I could bring my child back now, I would bring them back like that. Like, why would you not want somebody else's child to be brought back, you know, in this complete inability to comprehend how, you know, someone could advocate for that. And so I felt that in that specific division, you know, lay in many ways one of these fault lines around our common humanity, the same one that actually, you know, Mahmoud Mamdani refers to in his book Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, in a conversation he has with a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. And he says to the Holocaust survivor, you know, I would love to understand what you learn about those events. You know, what's the lesson that we should take away? Mm. And this Holocaust survivor responds, you know, never again.
Mm.
And Mamdani walks away from the conversation and he says, upon reflection, I realized that that statement could lend itself to two very different interpretations with very true. Different outcomes. Mm-hmm. The one is never again to me and my people at whatever cost
which
to everyone
probably
else,
not what it is.
Which is where we are right now,
yeah.
or never again to anyone.
Yeah.
And if it's never again to anyone, you are one of the people at these protests mm-hmm. standing up and saying, I survived a genocide, or my family survived a genocide. And because I did, and because we did, I could never stay silent on what I'm seeing right now, which is a combination, of course, of genocidal statements, genocidal language, genocidal music, you know, genocidal TikToks, you know, campaigns that are militarily designed to flatten entire neighborhoods, schools, universities, UN centers, targeting journalists. I mean, there is very little scope today to argue that this is not an attempt to completely annihilate the infrastructure and residents of the Gaza Strip, which is today 80% uninhabitable. And so I say this because the idea that I've just come back from a philosophy festival, which is called How the Light Gets In, where, you know, the great luminaries of the Western world come together to talk about the philosophical issues of the day. And I was repeatedly sort of made to feel that, you know, it was inconvenient or inappropriate to raise the Gaza issue, including with, you know, someone like Professor Peter Singer from Princeton University, who I was interviewing there. For a kind of legacy of his work. This is a man who spent 30 minutes answering a question about the sacredness of a cow's life and how we shouldn't be putting them into factory farming, which, by the way, I agree with, but couldn't say a word about children in Gaza. What the hell is this? What world is this? You know, and so I really struggle with the extent to which I think that there's a... You know, it's white supremacy ultimately that this comes down to, which is a notion that, you know, the never again should only be about me. And in the in protecting the me, it's okay if everybody else's children burn. And I could never subscribe to that. I don't know how people fully square that, but that is where we are right now.
Mm.
That allegedly defending some people's children is enough to justify other people's burning under, you know, plastic tents with 2,000 pound bombs.
We'd like to thank Dr. Miriam Francois for joining us for this week's episode. Part two of this incredible conversation will be out next week, so make sure you stay tuned. And thank you for listening to another episode of the ARPSIS podcast. As always, if you are enjoying it, all we ask is that you rate us and follow us wherever you listen. And also, if you particularly like this episode, share it with friends and family. Only with your help can these really important stories and conversations be heard. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with part 2.